get on the radio. All right. Well, what do you need to talk about? You need to talk about probably the overall function of the place, what the aims are, and
how you should go. I do that, or should David do that?
Well, maybe David should too, but why don't you?
Okay.
We can take whoever does it best. It'd be a contest, and the winner gets ice cream.
You're right. I've heard that before.
I never get any my ice cream,
I know. Well, the Florida Folklife Program was established in 1979 to document and also to serve as a cultural advocacy organization for the folk artists of the state. There is no such animal in many states. However, it's become much more prevalent in the past couple of years for states to support folk culture the same way that they would support archaeology or historic preservation. I know when I started working here in Florida as the folk arts coordinator for the state, which was back in 1976, we didn't have a program at that time. We just had one person here. There were only six states that had instituted a program such as this or had anyone in the state working to find the cultural resources that we're talking about. And at the moment, I believe there are 35 states that have programs devoted to folk culture. So in a matter of about 6 years, we've had a dramatic increase in interest in this, in the work that we do.
I hadn't really thought of it in terms of advocacy for... That means for the professionals, or does that also mean... That's interesting, because when you're in a situation like that for archaeologists, obviously you pay the money and they go out and dig in the ground. But with a folklorist who's working with the living tradition, does it also include support for the actual artists themselves?
Yeah, one of the basic things that we try to do is to get recognition for folk artists who have never gotten the kinds of... Well, people just aren't aware that they're around. They take them for granted, and maybe they don't even know that the guy next door has a particular skill that's really unique. And when we find people like this, we try to bring them to the public's attention, which gives them the kind of support that they need to continue doing whatever it is that they do. And a lot of times we find that it's just the kind of thing that brings them out of their shell and they're then able to pass on whatever it is that they're doing, whereas they never thought anyone was interested before. They're always amazed when somebody from the state, you know, as a state agency comes and says, what you're doing is really neat. Mm-hmm. We really think that we'd like you to come up to a folk festival and do this for thousands of people. And all of a sudden, they get exposure that they've never had before, and people have never seen what they're doing a lot of times. It depends, you know, if it's a crab trap maker or a blues singer or whatever. And they get that kind of emotional charge, I think, that gives them the strength to go on. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they were just about to stop whatever it was they were doing because mm-hmm. they just didn't feel it was useful to society or nobody cared. Mm-hmm. So in that way, we're advocates. Another way that in just monetary terms, we try to put people in touch with granting agencies, help people write grants to continue whatever it is they do, or perhaps we'll do a TV or radio documentary on them in that case, or try to give them an honorarium for their part in whatever it is we do. And we find that a lot of times when we start something, other people will continue whatever it is we've started, whereas if we find a musician who's never been before the public in 25 years, and other people hear that musician and decide, hey, you know, we'd like them to come for paying engagement here and there, and all of a sudden things start falling into place for them again. Mm-hmm. We're able to bring them out of obscurity, which mm-hmm. is really the neatest thing about it, I think, is to be able to give people that kind of support, monetary and emotional.
Describe how you do it. It's been fascinating to me. Doris mentioned that it was almost like detective work, what you do. You're following leads. Could describe a little bit how you would turn up someone like, say, Mary McLean. If that's a good example, or maybe think of a good example.
Right. Yeah, a lot of times, the real difficult part about doing folklore work is that you have to be... you have to be able to spend a lot of pre-research time finding your informants, especially it seems when you're usually going into a community cold, and maybe you have one contact, you know one name, and maybe, say in the case of the Finnish community of Lake Worth, you know that they have a Finnish radio show. So you have the name of the person who does the radio show. You follow up on that person gives you the name of the director of the Finnish American Rest Home, where you know there are a lot of elderly people who do some of the skills that you're looking for. You go to the rest home, you follow up on leads through there. One thing usually leads to another, if you're lucky. Sometimes you just run into a dead end for days where nobody knows nothing. You're looking and you're asking people for the kinds of things you're looking for, and nobody has any idea who does what. But most of the time you'll find one person who then is kind of your entree into the community, and you're able to meet other people, and one person leads to another. And it is like detective work. It's following up and kind of having your nose to the ground, keeping your eyes open. If you see a sign for Finnish bakery, for instance, you stop.
Well,
you would. Of course you stop, because we're always eating. It's the other thing that we do a lot of. But you stop so you can sample the bakery products, but also just because you know that there are people there who care enough about Finnish traditions that they're at least keeping the foodways alive. And more than likely, they know people who are doing music or who are doing crafts or whatever. And that's the way it just happens. And a lot of times you just be driving down the street and you see people on their front porch doing something really neat. I think that's how John found Alvin Goodvine, who makes whips. He was just driving around in the country and saw this old man sitting on his porch braiding a whip, and stopped and started talking to him. And turns out that he not only makes whips, he also grinds sugar cane and makes walking sticks and does a whole range of things that are very useful. And just by finding people, by keeping your nose to the ground, I guess is the way to do it, like a detective or a newspaper reporter. We often find that newspaper reporters are a very good source of informants, because feature writers are looking for some of the same kinds of people we are, people who are interesting, who are unique, and they work about the same way. They follow leads until they find their story. And many times we've been able to work cooperatively in a different... if we're in St. Petersburg, we will contact writers for the St. Petersburg Times who have already found several people for us who we needed to know about. In turn, we let them know about people that we find.
Then the next problem, well, obviously for a newspaper reporter, he'll write the story and it'll be in the paper, but you have an additional task now that you found these people to present them in a number of ways, and you have to devise those ways as well as present them. But tell a little about what sorts of programs you have.
Well, there are, I would say, one of the difficult tasks of being a folklorist is to know your informants and what their capabilities are as far as public exposure. In a way, we're advocates, and in another way, we're almost protectors of... I think of it in terms of, instead of environmental protection, you know, kind of a human resource protection, because many people are fragile in that they could not stand the public exposure of, like, coming onto a stage with 3,000 people out there wanting to hear whatever it is they do. Many people do not want to be inundated with reporters or tourists coming to see whatever it is they do. And so you have to be really careful about how you present the kinds of people you find. We've had cases where we've gone and recorded and taken photographs of people and then never done anything else with them because we, you know, maybe they're 95 years old and in poor health and just wouldn't be appropriate to take them into the schools and have 200 school children, you know, just inundate them with questions. They wouldn't be able to handle that. And then there are other cases where we find people who can do almost anything that we would like them to do. They can come to festivals and they love it. They can go into the schools and they love it. They make perfect, they're very articulate, so they can be used for radio and TV purposes. We do a wide range of things that include bringing the public face to face with our folk artists and also bringing the public into contact with them in a secondhand way. For instance, some people just would not be available and ready to go to a public forum like a festival or into the schools, but they're perfectly well suited for perhaps being the subject of a slide tape show where they actually don't have to go out of their home environment. We go and document the environment, and then we bring the environment in a secondhand way to the schools in a slide tape program or in a videotape or in a radio show, for instance. And that works very well in some cases. And as I say, if nothing else, we do want to document what's happening, even if we don't, if we're not able to develop it at the moment into a public program, it's available for future generations in, you know, a documented form in our archives. So.
I was talking with Doris about the two different aspects of a folklorist's work, the first collecting the material, and the second evaluating and interpreting the material. What, how would you say that balances out with your work? Which do you do more of here? Is that a hard or a ridiculous question?
No, it's not. In fact, that's been one of the criticisms of early folklorists, and this is something that happens quite a bit, is that when you're a collector, you tend to collect and collect and collect and collect, but you never do anything with the material you collect. And so when you die, there are mountains of material that people try to wade through, but really the best person to do an analysis and evaluation of the material is a collector themselves. And so in the past we've had cases where, you know, folklorists will go out and do excellent collections, but then nothing is done with them for years and years, and then someone many years later has to try to make sense out of what actually happened and try to reconstruct, you know, what's happening. Luckily in our work, I feel that we have a really good balance between collecting and presenting, and mainly because of our public mandate. If we just collected material and put it in the archive, I don't think we would be in a state agency very long, because we are responsible ultimately to our constituents, to the people of Florida. We have to keep a high visibility for the program and let people know that we're here and that we're doing something for the state. Which is very good because it keeps us responsible. And usually what we do is we don't actually go out and collect until we know that we have a project in mind and we're going to try to find out, for instance, what the lore of cowboys are in Florida, because we're going to actually put together an exhibit or something that will go back to the people. And then we'll have the funds to go out and do the collection. We don't get a lot of money to just go out and do independent research at all.
Sort of abstract, pure research, you don't do that.
No, and that's always been kind of a sore point too, in that ideally there would be some funds available to do just pure research, because you never know what that can be used for in the future. But what happens most of the time in public sector folklore work is that you write a grant for a particular project, for a product, for something tangible that will result within a year. and you are under pressure with deadlines, that's what I mean. And you do develop a product out of the research. And if you didn't have that grant to do the product, you wouldn't have the money to go ahead and do the research or the time.
We probably ought to talk a little bit about what some of the programs are of the center. Okay, obviously there's the Folk Festival. That's probably the one that people know about the most, I guess. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Is that where you get most of your public participation?
Well,
exposure?
Yeah, I would say that the Florida Folk Festival is the most visible program that we do. All festivals are kind of a highly visible and intense time and money and energy intensive project. Everybody in the program and all of our resources are put together for several months ahead of the festival, and then we do a large festival in May. And I would say that the public probably knows about us most through the festival. It's been going on for it'll be 31 years this year. So that would be the one program that I think consumes most of our energy for about half of the year. Aside from the festival, though, we do have other programs that have started gaining more visibility. We have started a media program where we're doing television documentary and radio programs, slide tape programs for schools, and so far 3 record albums. These are starting to be rented and sold, and people are starting to know about us through these products. And they're something that go beyond a folk festival in that they continue to be used year-round. They don't just happen on a 4-day weekend, mm-hmm. and then they're forgotten about for the rest of the year. We have a project right now with the State Library in which we will be putting up exhibits and doing public programs in 22 library sites around the state, which will bring us into almost every area in the state, from Naples to Pensacola, Miami, Jacksonville, Orlando, and many smaller libraries like in Marianna and Polk City, in places that probably would never have had a program like this and an exhibit that, to explain what Florida folklore is, and have people actually come into the library like you would have people come into the schools and demonstrate whatever tradition it is that they do.
Mm-hmm.
We have an exhibits program where we have 2 traveling exhibits and an exhibit that will be permanent here at the Folk Culture Center in White Springs. An entire museum will be remounted to reflect what the folklore of Florida is. At the moment, it's a museum dedicated to Stephen Foster, and there will be now a division where the folklore of Florida actually will have a visitor center here where people can come and know about our program, and that will help too. We do several other festivals, help with technical assistance on festivals around the state, and do a 4th of July celebration.
In a traditional sort of way?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We do old-fashioned games and watermelon eating contests and free watermelon, the kind of thing that you would have at a family reunion or a community 4th of July celebration.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to stick to that and make it basically for the 3 counties that really host the program here, mm-hmm. in rural North Florida. I'm trying to think of what other programs we have going right now.
That's quite a bit there.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that controversial about the museum, off the record?
Yeah. It was for a while, but they're moving all the Stephen Foster stuff over to the tower.
Oh, that's a good idea.
All the dioramas and everything.
Oh, that'd be lovely.
And
I haven't heard that. That's nice.
Yeah, so
move.
I know. But
well, let's see, what else do we need to cover? Do you want to talk about the staff at all, about this sort of activities that the staff, I guess that'll all be covered in the program by talking to individual people.
Did you ask anybody how they got into what they do?
Yeah, would you like to have a go at it?
Yeah. How did I get into it? Well, I never knew that you could study folklore.
That's what a lot of them say.
It was something that my high school counselor, I'm sure, never knew that you could study folklore either. It was a very well-kept secret. There are only 10 universities across the country that offer a degree in it. And unless you knew about them, perhaps lived in the same city with one of the universities, mm-hmm. you wouldn't know that there was such a discipline. Or, you know, and when I decided what I was going to do with my life, I was an art major in undergraduate school, and I graduated and got a job in a museum where I actually ran into somebody who had studied folklore, which just floored me. I had no idea, you know, I thought they were pulling my leg, but they weren't. I sent away for some catalogs and found out that there was something that combined a lot of things I was interested in, because I was not only interested in traditional arts from my art background, but I had been a folk interpreter, a folk music interpreter, I guess you would call it, for many years. Been playing the guitar and doing the coffee house circuit, and had been interested in collecting songs from real folk, and had been doing that for many years. And then I was also really interested in oral traditions, like superstitions and belief systems, and interested in people that way. And so when I found out that you could study it, I was living in upstate New York, and I knew that the school I wanted to go to was in Kentucky, and I didn't even know where Kentucky was. I had to look it up on the map. Oh. I was so provincial. I had never lived anywhere outside of New England and upstate New York, and of course, in my own stereotyped way, I thought, well, what a perfect place to study folklore. Kentucky is like the end of the world. Sure. And after I studied, I did go to Western Kentucky University and got my degree. I realized that there was so much folklore in New York State that had been all around me all the time, and I had never even looked at it. And that's what really is the beauty of the whole thing, is that once you realize what folklore is, it's everywhere. I mean, Appalachia is not the fount of all knowledge as far as folklore is concerned. And so it didn't seem unusual to me when I got a call from Florida saying, come on down and collect folklore in Florida. Because at that point, I knew that Florida couldn't be just all beaches and palm trees and flamingos and mink stoles, and that even if it was, there was a lot of folklore in that. And so I ended up down here.
Well, let's do a little bit of self-help here.
Yeah.
One of the constant themes that's been coming through all these interviews, and if we name the program what we think we're going to name the program, Everyday yeah. Treasures. How would you tell someone who doesn't know what folklore is? You said that there was a time when you didn't even know that such a thing as a folklore study existed, and many people look at folklorists and say, well, what the heck is it that you really do? What is it that you're interested in? Where would just an ordinary person look for folklore in his life? Where do you look in your life for signs of folklore? What sort of places can people look? This is just for the radio show.
Okay. Wait, let me think a minute.
How can you tell if what you're doing is folklore? Maybe that's a better way to get at it.
How you can tell that what you are doing or what you've just done is a bit of your own folklore is that every once in a while you'll stop and say, now why did I do that? And you realize you have no idea in the world why you just did that, but it's just done.
What, can you give an example?
I grew up, and when I would do something and my mother would find out about it, and I thought I'd kept a real good secret. I'd ask her, well, how did you know? And she said, oh, a little bird told me. Mm. And I never thought much about it until I grew up and started studying folklore. Then one day I heard myself saying it, and I thought, now that is really, why do I say that? A little bird told me. That didn't make much sense at all to me. Obviously, I was repeating what my mother had said, and she was probably repeating what her mother had said, who was repeating it ad infinitum. And since I was fortunate enough to have access to a folklore archive, I started looking up that particular saying and perhaps finding out what the origin of that was, and come to find out it has a very fascinating history. In almost every culture of the world, birds are truth-sayers. In the Odyssey, if you wanted to tell the future, you cut up a bird and you find out what the entrails tell you. In the Arabian Nights, it's the parrot who informs on the wife of the Sultan. And you can find in all the early oral literature of every country, they have birds playing this function. Hmm. Our bluegrass number, Pretty Polly, which is actually derived from an old English ballad originally, where Pretty Polly never was the girl who gets killed. In the English ballad, Pretty Polly is a parrot who saves a girl from being killed by squawking at the right moment, so she turns around and finds her assailant. And when I started digging into this, I thought, well, maybe that's where we get the expression stool pigeon. Mm-hmm. And the more you start digging into expressions that you use, just little things that you do that are so much a part of your vocabulary or your belief system, you don't even think about it. Mm-hmm. Most people think of superstitions as superstitions now because we kind of poo-poo that, you know. I mean, if you don't walk under a ladder, you're very conscious of the mm-hmm. fact you're doing it because that's a quote-unquote superstition. But you blow out candles on a birthday cake just because you do. I mean, you don't think about it much. You just, they're there, so you
it's
blow
the sort of
them
thing
out.
You think of everybody does it, but everybody doesn't do it, and you don't know that, and maybe that's the function of the folklore.
Well, that's it. Until you come in contact with somebody who's not of your, who doesn't share that tradition and points it out to you a lot of times, you never mm-hmm. know that it's unique. Mm-hmm. I mean, until you go to another country and realize that Thanksgiving is an American celebration, you're never conscious that it's not something mm-hmm. everybody doesn't do, and maybe you don't even think about why you're doing it, mm-hmm. since we've forgotten about the Indians and the Pilgrims for the mm-hmm. most part. Mm-hmm. We just eat.
So that's a real function of a folklorist, is to point these special traits out to people that they just take
right.
for granted. They don't think anything about them, although they're such a vital part of their lives, and they enrich their lives. There's no doubt of that. It does make
it's something where we really do try to point out the everyday treasure of people's lives.
Good job. Good work. That's great. Wow. I'm just so stunned. That's wonderful. Where do we go from here? You think that's enough? I think with
oh,
the rest
yeah.
of it.
That's when you think